Where do you find yourself even tending toward? You've entered it just now, but what do you do, or what should we do politically?
Yes.
We're trying to forge some kind of new politics that's capable of standing against some of these, as you say, racist, misogynist movements in society.
I guess my answer again is to go back to Kolakowski's concept of the left, and that is what Civilization clearly is trying to become. And one should be alive to possibilities through elections and whatever other means present themselves, but you've got to do that first. Build that concept of the left.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
we still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast.
I'm Jack Ross. I am the author of the new book with Sublation, The Strange Death of American Exceptionalism.
So on the book jacket, it describes the book as being of interest to both the left and the right, and anyone who's interested in or still clings to the American creed, that is a strong commitment to civil liberties and the embrace of individual rights over group rights. Why does that matter? As a socialist, shouldn't you be against individualism?
There's a lot to unpack when it comes to bringing a socialist label into things. Of all the stereotypes from 20th century, the post-war era, about what liberals were, and I shouldn't say stereotypes because also very meaningful things about liberalism or Bill of Rights, sense of fairness. I remember back all those years ago how I would put it when it was still very subtle phenomenon, and you only first had a publication like Vox was first bursting on to the scene. That I remember how I thought about it then was it used to be the old line about a liberal being someone who wouldn't take his own side in argument, and that was, and even already by the Obama years, that was clearly absolutely not true anymore. And year after, the SP book came out, and obviously I became very hopeful about the Bernie Sanders campaign and the timing there. But then just in 2016, once we started seeing what became Russiagate and the whole tone of Hillary Clinton campaign by her convention, just really all crystallized around her convention, and just having written so the civil libertarian history, this was all of Wilson's reign of terror during World War I happening all over again, all the same premises, political speeches, espionage, if not treason, journalism is treason, or the very least, espionage. I will say, and this may also be a discussion, I do feel like the facts have changed somewhat, and a lot more caution. It could very quickly change this election year, I'll certainly grant that, but I do have a lot more caution. To bring up one author is very relevant to this, to my new book, or a lot of the core premises or ideas behind the new book, Ross Douthat. In early Trump years, when I was very anxious about what people were calling the deep state and whatnot, and about the mystery about Russiagate, I do feel like some like Ross Douthat was vindicated in being a lot more ambivalent or jaded about it. In a much, much larger sense, his whole thesis about the decadent society, which is a book I certainly would urge all viewers to read. And I certainly feel like having written this book and certainly in the later stage of its development with a lot more political hope, or as an underlying premise anyway, that then proved to be warranted for this cycle, that we would actually move on from Trump and maybe even from Biden. And Trump, I do feel like the hope that rather than the worst fears that we may have had in 2016 or 2020, that the decadence thesis of simply repetition and just overall unseriousness is a lot more salient to.
Okay. I threw you a curveball there because I had intended to just ask you a bit more of a succinct question. So maybe, do you have a pen and paper with you by any chance?
Okay, let me see that.
Sometimes I find it helpful during an interview. I've always got a pen and paper with me, and I just jot down the question, and so that as I'm talking, I can keep going back to that question as I give my answer, and it just helps keep a focus a little bit, maybe just a little bit better, because you have to remember, we're going to try to bring in more of a general audience. Like we have an intelligent audience, but want to not assume too much knowledge about what's going on. So it'd be good to maybe write down the question and have in mind answering that question and leave out too much extraneous detail. And we can try to keep a little bit more focus on the question. And I'll try a little bit harder to not to throw you a curveball. So the next question I want to ask.
If I could just say that I hear all that. I do feel like I did think, though, I was doing well to set up the more specific questions about the core. I thought I did a good job setting up the core questions about the arguments of the book.
So you've written The Strange Death of American Exceptionalism. What do you want people to get from this? What, when people put down the book, what's the core idea you hope sticks in their mind?
Kevin Phillips wrote The Emerging Republican Majority in immediate aftermath of 1968 election, had basically a century of massive political geography and election statistics going back to basically Reconstruction period. And his argument was, whereas in the most basic version of realignment theory, you simply have a generational cycle that most accounts go as the election of Andrew Jackson to the election of Lincoln to William McKinley, 1896, and then FDR, and then finally Nixon, something more profound happened in 1968, which was an entire century party system that was a consequence of Civil War geography that came completely undone, and you had a national majority that was conservative in character and that transcended geography. And when, by the 1990s, when Kevin Phillips became very understandably completely sick of politics and wrote and decided to look at history and wrote a book called The Cousins Wars that described the continuities from the English Civil War to the American Revolution to the American Civil War, he described in his introduction how, as the project developed, it became evident to him that this was very much the prequel or prologue. I'm not sure the word prequel really existed yet when he wrote that book, but which is to say, you had a two-century epoch defined by this transcendent Anglo-American process that was bookended by the English and American Civil Wars. And that was succeeded then by the post-Civil War party system that ended in 1968. And I read this book just after I was done the major promotion of my book on the Socialist Party in the fall of 2015, and Bernie Sanders' campaign was happening, and I suddenly realized, oh, I should write that book about the 50 years after that, because it was clear to me that was ending, and I immediately was able to associate that ending with the concept of the end of American exceptionalism. It was an essay that I had hoped would grow into something much bigger, but never did, by Peter Beinart in National Journal, where he identified the three pillars of American exceptionalism: religiosity, sense of mission abroad, and persistent belief and persistent up social mobility. And that essay, all did was just throw out polling data to show that millennials, who were still almost kids then, rapidly declining belief in those three pillars. So I immediately understood as the turning point we were at, 2016 election represented. I would say, incidentally, just to keep things somewhat current, in the 1968 election, what Kevin Phillips and others described it when things were still not obvious, because, among other things, in the popular vote, Nixon only beat Humphrey by less than a percentage point, with George Wallace gaining 13% of the vote. I suspect, based on the most recent polls, that what we could see this year in 2024 is a negative landslide against Biden, even if it's very close between him and Trump, and that the combined Trump-Kennedy vote could, 4 years from now, as Nixon had over McGovern in 1972. And if you look at the 68 election and simply combine the Nixon and Wallace totals and isolate the states where Humphrey was able to get over 50% of the vote, he did not do very much better than McGovern did 4 years later. And that is a historically significant point when it comes to the rise of neoconservatism and how many of its premises. And of course, the rise of neoconservatism led directly into the George W. Bush presidency and all of its disasters. Kevin Phillips talked about these demographic patterns or ethno-religious tribalism, and that was the template in which, after 1865, the different tribes no longer took up arms against each other. When you say, why the 17th century, when you pose the question that way, my first thought is to think of another very important book, David Hackett Fisher, Albion Seed, where he talks about the four British folkways and of how they settled the colonies and how a lot of the patterns, even up through Kevin Phillips in the 20th century, can be traced back to that. And yes, later immigration did arrange itself around a lot of those fault lines. And yes, the non-white populations in numerous particulars, certainly well beyond voting behavior, can be placed within that framework in developing political cycles as well. But because in 1968 what you saw was the complete breakdown, whether it was the South, between the South and most of the rest of the country, save the Northeast or the Protestant Northeast. Kevin Phillips' quite charmingly dated phrase for the Democratic Minority Coalition was the establishmentarian Northeast and the Negro South. If you had between the Catholic Protestant fault line, which was certainly critical, as well as the geographical fault line. In other words, all of that broke down within the white majority coalition after 1968, and any of those fault lines that were relevant to political and elections history before that became even out of memory. And what I see is so significant about 2016, because we also haven't brought up Brexit and the similar patterns in Britain, and the fact that these happened the same year. You can map the Brexit vote onto the four folkways, that is, the specific regions of Great Britain where different colonists hailed from, and the ways those regions evolved. You can map that completely onto where they settled in the United States, and both in the colonial period and then in their westward expansion to the Trump vote in very significant ways. And it's been incredible to me that I'm not aware of anyone else who's played this out in all the years since 2016. Even what remained of those fault lines, even what remained of the historic class character of the two parties after 1968, those are the things that have completely broken down in and after the 2016 election. And that has much bigger implications. It's very arguably culmination of an entire 400-year civilizational epoch that began with the English Civil War. Certainly, where you are in the UK, questions about the monarchy and any number of other things can be connected to that. And how to get deeper into the book, I mentioned the three pillars: religiosity, sense of mission in the world, and belief in persistent mobility. The latter two can certainly be traced of Rohmer as well. The decline of American religiosity and catching up to Europe in secularization, that really is the fundamental driver. Before the whole nature of the Trump phenomenon became obvious in 2016, that was what was clear over the course of the Obama years, just how far-reaching the consequences of the collapse of the Christian right from the failures of the Bush presidency would be.
What you're saying is that we have a collapse of religiosity, a sense of mission, and belief in social mobility. And this is reflected across the political spectrum?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and so one thing that I had noticed, and you mentioned that this is the culmination of the end of a kind of civilizational epoch. A lot of the framing now in terms of our culture wars or our politics is a civilizational framing. So people will say this insert issue is really a battle between civilization and barbarism, or civilization and those who wish to destroy it, or whatever it might be. Can you reflect on that? Or do you think that's relevant to the thesis of your book, that we seem to play out so many of our battles in civilizational terms?
On the one hand, I definitely want to resist apocalypticism. And as I said, if there's one fundamental takeaway, it's that there's nothing new going on here. Again, this is why I bring up the decadence thesis, and I don't see either side as particularly on the side of civilization rather than barbarism. I'll be frank, I've been burned pretty bad by what I thought might be a possibility of a decent right after 2020, and I can remember, as I wrestled with the gradual unraveling of that, of thinking through why we need a decent right before we can have a decent left.
That's quite an interesting question, because it does lead us to, I think, one of the core questions that you're trying to answer, which is, why do we not see a rebirth of class politics?
I think we do have a class politics in a way we didn't before, but that isn't dispositive what those politics are and whether they're positive or negative. I don't want to go completely into false consciousness territory when it comes to Trump or anyone else on the right, whatever I may think of them. But but there's also another sense, as much as I am usually loath to avoid cliched leftist thinking or sloganeering, I think there is a sense in which socialism or barbarism is a valid point at the present moment, which, or in other words, that part of the reason I've been so excited to become involved with Sublation is because we're building something new. We're not focused on a strange experience of radicalism under decadence, where you get to enact Weimar online without any of the real world consequences. That we are looking to build the thing of the future, to build something humane. And this is, I was actually reading over last night and yesterday because of its relevance. It may get into fairly out there territory, at least for now, what the context is of a new project I'm working on, but I'm reading Kolakowski's Concept of the Left, and which is basically exactly what trying to set a foundation for, and hopefully can become part of and help shape a much larger movement that ultimately can bring us back to decent politics, but in the meantime to build a foundation that can save actual humane learning amidst the barbarism.
So you talked about these cycles, that we've seen these cycles before. At the end of a cycle, what is produced that is new? What tends to come out of these things?
If we're just talking about political party alignments, I don't know that you can really describe it as something new. It's just a rearrangement of demographic alignments, or as I believe Henry Adams, politics is a contest of organized hatreds. But in larger sense, I think, is a good place to bring in the other major author I relied on and was also very, in many ways, more significantly so than Kevin Phillips, emblematic of the whole lost 20th century political science understanding of America, and that's Samuel Huntington. Specifically, a book he wrote in an attempt to understand the 1960s called American Politics, Promise of Disharmony. And he described what he called as the creedal passion cycle, which I found does line up with the more epochal turning points, as opposed to simply the election realignment cycle when it comes to larger cultural and social reinventions in American society. And he discusses the English Civil War, but he basically takes it American Revolution, abolitionism in the Civil War, Progressive Era, World War One, and then the 1960s. And if you do the math, the Great Awakening, long cultural nightmare, whatever we want to call it, lines up perfectly to that. And the critical distinction between these two, and first let me say what Huntington identified as the central cause of these creedal passion periods is the gap between ideals and institutions, when the gap between society's ideals and how they're enacted by the institutions become, which there's always that tension always exists in society, but when when the tension becomes unmanageable and there's a need for a greater upheaval. The reason this is critical for talking about the left or the history of the left or bad history of the left, Huntington made a very important point that the New Deal was not a creedal passion period and lays out very specifically why it was and why it wasn't. And that was a class that had more to do with issues of class and the economic system.
What's a creedal passion cycle? What's a creedal passion period?
I guess it usually starts with a political or social protest movement that then gains critical mass, and historically is also important, and it usually would conclude in war as fulfillment, which certainly happened in the American Revolution and Civil War. And then World War I proved exceptional because it was actually fulfilled through a foreign war, which, and the fact that Vietnam could not, was for many reasons unable to serve that same function, nor should it have, to be clear. Certainly World War I shouldn't have either, but that's another matter. That's a significant point. I was just to, that I don't forget the point about the New Deal not being a creedal passion period. That is basically the popular front myth of American history, that is basically that the New Deal actually was a creedal passion cycle. The communists were the radical Republicans. It's their failure was the failure of Reconstruction. And yes, I certainly would also argue as well that a lot of trendy history of Reconstruction is derived from the backward reading of that myth by pundits who want to refight the war, in not so many words. But so I mentioned about Vietnam and why that mattered. But the other thing, but this is absolutely central to my book, Huntington simply took for granted that in every period, the ideals in question were the ideals of the American creed, put succinctly, the value system derived from the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, but that because those were the positive values of anti-communism and of the better half of Cold War liberalism, yes, there was a lot of militarist technocracy that also fell under that heading, and unpacking the better and worse halves of Cold War liberalism will have to be a topic for another day. But because anti-communism, which was the most broadly accepted narrative of national purpose in American history after World War II, because it was discredited by Vietnam, ultimately, over the long run, its positive values, meaning the American creed, basic civil libertarian ethos, again, as derived from the Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights, that, however, slowly and imperceptibly unraveled over the course of the whole post-Vietnam era, which is basically what I call the half century from 1968 election to give or take the 2016 election.
So what typically happens then is you have this cycle where you have this drift of the actual institutions of society from their sort of founding ideas or their founding values. And then you have some kind of upheaval that attempts to somehow bring them back into alignment. But this didn't happen because the Vietnam War was not successful in doing that. Have I completely ruined the argument, or is that kind of where you were going?
You've certainly not ruined it, but that doesn't quite do it justice, because if we're talking about the 60s, the initial creedal passion, of course, was the civil rights movement. And if We simply think about it in terms of extending the creedal passion, I guess you'd say, of the civil rights movement beyond to a larger society-wide project than simply securing political freedom and the means of upward social mobility to African Americans. Look at the Port Huron Statement, for instance, which, for all that can or should be criticized about it, in 1962, still very much was a restatement of the American creed, of that value system that needed to be renewed within American institutions. What happened in a number of different ways as a consequence of Vietnam was that there was a turn against that. As I say in the book, you can look at the history of SDS, certainly relevant in this connection, how it went from the Port Huron Statement, as I described it, to the nature of its implosion, various Maoist sects and other violent groups that came out of it, and certainly in the last 6 months since the massacres in Israel, we've seen in full flower Frantz Fanon propaganda. As I say in the book, that was not more than a microcosm of the larger story of what happened as a consequence of Vietnam, but it was the paradigm of the nation as a whole.
Could you explain that last statement? It was the paradigm of the nation of a whole. What do you mean by that?
In other words, there's a very good case to be made that the rise and fall of SDS can be seen as a microcosm of the much larger, much longer story of how American society over time abandoned the belief in the American creed.
So we abandon this belief. It's not being renewed, and we have this rise of what in its place now. How are we trying to reconstruct politics in this void, or are we?
One critical thing to say in response to that is that whatever that might mean, it absolutely does not mean the resistance liberal narrative about our democracy. About there have been moments, and many more than I would have even acknowledged just a couple of years ago. And when I say just a couple of years ago, that's even after January 6th, but when, yes, an idea of Trump just doing crude textbook anti-democratic things were plausible, though I would also say even now that as much worse as the actual things he'll say is now from 5 or 6 years ago, they still seem to very clearly be signs of weakness. And Rostow that had the brilliant column about, if anyone remembers the Simpsons episode where Mr. Burns goes to the Mayo Clinic and they show how all of his many and horrible diseases are in perfect balance. I mean, Rostow that laid out brilliantly how all the things that we thought would critically weaken Trump over the last year and a half have proven to have a boomerang effect, and the very fact that they kept him more out of public attention or from being that much more in public eye or media, and then combined, of course, with the Democratic overperformance in the midterms leading to their overreach. But what I say about the whole resistance, liberal fascism narrative, because I still think it's as fundamentally wrong as I ever have. And
before you argue against it, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by the resistance liberal fascist.
Okay, less important than, because I've already said about why I don't, at least as of this moment, have very many of the worst fears that I had in the early Trump years about the resistance. But it's less a matter of that than what are they for, to the extent one can argue what they're for. When they talk about, I know you're a fan of Christopher Lash, and the concept of his that I have found so incredibly helpful in understanding the history of the last decade is, quote, that is when he says what is meant by democracy is by so much of the new class, or how we defined it in the beginning of this conversation, is the democratization of self-esteem. And that's to say, take an extreme example, if I hear some Hollywood person just in the most casual way imaginable mention the Dobbs decision in January 6th in that order, as though they don't make that distinction, they can't make distinctions, and that's how unserious they are about it all. And as extreme as example I'm thinking of might be, that's why I'm more skeptical about the worst fears about the Biden deep state as a lot of other people. There's just a profound unseriousness. The DNC or whoever was not behind trying to get Trump off ballots or even most of the criminal cases. These are actors who, in most cases, are just taking it on their own, going out on their own, and it's for the most part blowing up in their faces. Michael Wolff, who is the reliable chronicler of the Trump presidency and the Trump phenomenon as opposed to the Baroque Russiagate narratives, I wasn't totally ready to believe him, but when he wrote about why all the Trump legal cases could be self-defeating like everything else has, that seems to be bearing out right now. And combine that with just how complacent the establishment has been these last several months about the growing probability of Trump winning the election. So, unseriousness, that's the first point. But, so there's an unseriousness, and when I mention what Christopher Lash calls a democratization of self-esteem, that it's not about, I mentioned RFK Jr. earlier, and I'm not thrilled about the guy by any means, but when people talk of like some big conspiracy of the Federalist Society or whoever, or paranoid ideas about gerrymandering or voting rights or whatever, a very formative political experience for me is, I guess, give or take college years in the 2000s was opposition to two-party system, which certainly informed a lot of my book on the Socialist Party and a lot of aspects of it that a lot of the Cold War era historians miss. But specifically 2004, first election I could vote in, and just how completely arbitrarily and without apology, the Democrats, wherever they could, used whatever legal means they could to keep Ralph Nader off the ballot. And I ended up not voting for him in the end. You can read Socialist Party book to see something about who I actually did cast my first vote for in 2004. But I don't know exactly how serious the talk of that kind of pushing against RFK Jr., for that matter, Jill Stein or Cornel West. I don't know if that's as serious as it was in 2004. I know who I can ask, and I think there's good reason to suspect it's not. But I even went to a couple conferences of leftists in the early 2000s when a lot of that voting rights narrative was still in its more fringe protean form. And finally, the other argument that is a core argument I make in my book, and is certainly core to understanding the spirit of the culture war. And yes, it's more than somewhat ironic. And yes, there are not that many people who particularly want to hear it who think it's a good thing, of those who think it's a good thing. But all of the talk about the Supreme Court and rollback of so-called rights revolution, whether we're talking about what we all understood civil rights and anti-racism to mean until the day before yesterday, or civil rights on the basis of sex as opposed to gender, or the First Amendment, pretty much. I mean, I know there's some pessimism after the hearing, which I rightly or wrongly take with a little grain of salt, but if the Section 230 case, it does go the wrong way, it will indeed be a function of lack of appreciation for this reality, or many of the idiocies and worse than idiocies associated with the Trumpish right, let's say. But in other words, the quote conservative revolution in the judiciary is all about preserving and defending the legacy of the Cold War era liberal judiciary, of having an expansive idea of the Bill of Rights based on individual rights, based on the American Creed, an idea, a civil libertarian idea that we can obviously have a discussion, and I know that's a subject of great interest to sublation about the American revolutionary experience and how it ran aground. And I would certainly argue that that it wasn't in time, was there at the time of the revolution. The idea of the understanding of the Bill of Rights that manifested in the birth of the civil libertarian ethos after World War I.
So to clarify, that's where you think that battle is being fought at the moment.
Again, these things are always accidental. It's a very common occurrence in human history that when a counter-revolution comes to power and what it ends up actually doing or being there to do is to preserve the preceding revolution against a counter-revolution from the other direction. But no, it's defending against an idea that rights should be based on the democratization of self-esteem, of group rights, or a paradigm based on identity. Or
what do we, as socialists, communists, or Marxists, do now at this junction, at this point in history? What's our, I know it's a huge question, that's the question of our times, and maybe that's just the answer, but where do you find yourself even tending toward? You've answered it just now, but what do you do, or what should we do politically? Yes. We're trying to forge some kind of new politics that's capable of standing against some of these, as you say, racist, misogynist movements in society.
I guess my answer again is to go back to Kolakowski's concept of the left. And that is what sublation clearly is trying to become. And one should be alive to possibilities through elections and whatever other means present themselves. But you've got to do that first. Build that concept of the left.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.